Hi, this is Terry Kuzma from Penn State University. Today I'd like to present Materials and Nanotechnology, ESI 213. We're going to go over today plasma and materials. So let's take a look at today's outline. What we're going to look at is a brief introduction. So we're going to describe some variables, and then we'll take a brief review, a look at some models to understand plasma processing. And then we'll look at specific chemistries for some popular materials that exist in nanotechnology. And I think it's important to look at those, specific, ideas, but use them as an algorithm to see what kinds of, etchants could use, etch what type of materials. Then we're going to look at, analyzing recipe parameters and the resultant etch profiles. I guess this is the meat of the presentation, where we want to actually look at, the different energy parameters that we can control in an etch system. And then we could actually predict what we're going to get as an etch profile. And then at the end of the presentation, we can look at the endpoint technology, which is a plasma characterization technology. Look at those, use them as an algorithm. Etchants could use etch what type of materials, recipe parameters, and the resultant etch profiles. I guess vocabulary we need to review. These things should have been presented in previous lectures, but if you're just tuning into this lecture, we can bring you back up to speed here really quickly. So reactive ion etching. This is a process where the substrate is placed on an RF-powered electrode to achieve a chemical and a physical etch. So what we have to look at is those letters RIE. So the R stands for reactive, and that's the chemistry part of the reaction that takes place. So what we're trying to do is chemically remove material from the surface, take some kind of solid material and turn it into a gas. So that's the reactive part. The I stands for ion. So that's actually the bombardment part. So what we'll have is a charged particle come down to the surface. And what that does is impinge on the surface with a certain amount of energy, hopefully over the threshold binding energy. And that'll release an atom or a molecule or something like that. And naturally the E stands for etch. So that's what reactive ion etch is. And basically it stands for the chemistry and the bombardment to remove material from a surface. So that's what RIE stands for. The aspect ratio. This is the ratio of the depth to the width for a small gap, trench, or hole. So that's important. So in reactive ion etch, because we have different energy parameters, we can actually have a feature where the depth is larger than the width. And that's really important, because if we would contrast that against wet etching, in wet etching, you would always have the width be, for the most part, a little bit slightly larger than the depth, and that would be rounded. So what we're getting out of reactive ion etch is the terminology aspect ratio, and that means that we can control unique etch parameters and make unique etch profiles in systems. The DC bias is a DC voltage that develops across the plasma process chamber when an RF voltage is applied to the chamber's electrodes. So if you'll recall in our review, past lectures, we discussed the hardware associated with reactive ion etching. So in a reactive ion etch tool, the power supply is capacitively coupled to the substrate. And what happens is that capacitor will block the electrons that are disassociated in the plasma from going to ground. So they build up on the surface of the substrate. So at that point, the DC bias, which is negative voltage, builds up on the substrate. So that tells a nice story that leads to the story of, now we can put a positively charged particle in the plasma, and it'll be attracted to that DC plane. And that's what gives us the I and ion reactive ion etch system. That's what gives us the bombardment in there. So it's the ions that actually are attracted to the negative DC bias on the cathode where the substrate resides. The mean free path. This is a mathematical term. It's the average distance an atom or molecule travels before striking another atom or molecule in the vacuum chamber. So what we do for the mean free path, we actually control the pressure in the etch system. And when we control the pressure, we control the average mean free path. And what that's going to do is control our disassociation and the amount of ions that we produce and then the amount of electrons that we can collect on the substrate. So actually, the mean free path is a very important mathematical construct, because it allows us to think about the DC bias, and it allows us to think about bombardment. So that really gives us the big picture for reactive ion etch. Radicals, this is kind of like the chemistry. So radicals are molecules or fragments of molecules that contain unsatisfied bonds, and these are extremely reactive materials. So this is kind of like the chemistry part in reactive iron etch, the radicals. So that's the chemical constituent. The mean free path would lend itself to the ions, which would give us the DC bias. And again, this is all wrapped up to give us the aspect ratio, because when we control these two energies, the chemistry and the ion bombardment, when we put those two energies together and we vary those energy vectors, we can get different aspect ratios. So to me, these terms are all, you know, on one page, and at least in my mind, they're in one set that they are coupled to each other. So we have here is the ions. They're atoms or molecules or pieces of molecules that have gained or lost electrons. They can be negatively charged or positively charged. And basically, you know, in our scenario, if you recall from reviewing the hardware of an etch system, a reactive ion etch system, a capacitively coupled system, the ions that we really care about quite a bit are positively charged ions. So when an ion bangs into another, or when an atom smashes into another atom, what can potentially happen is an electron could be knocked free. And what happens now is that particular atom or molecule becomes positively charged because it lost an electron. Those electrons can be gathered on the surface of the substrate by the capacitor. So that sets up our etch process. So now we have positively charged material in our plasma, and we have a negative plane. So that allows us to use these ions as a kinetic energy source. So they'll smash into the surface because they want to recombine to that negative plane. And those ions now become our kinetic energy part of our equation in here. The etch rate is the speed at which materials remove from the substrate during etching. Residence time. And the speed, this etch rate, again, maybe I should review that a little bit. Our goal here is to take a solid and turn it into a gas. So we would call that a volatile product. So we want to take some type of material, you know, the etchant material, whether it's the chemistry or the kinetic energy from an ion, and we want to take that and actually remove that material selectively from the surface. So that's represented by the etch rate. The residence time, this is the average time that the gas spends in a vacuum chamber. So it's an interesting thing if you could think back to the hardware that we discussed before, that you can actually have a certain pressure in a system, say 20 millitorr, but at that pressure, the gas doesn't have to be in there for any particular amount of time. The gas could be static in there at 20 millitorr, or we could have a huge volume of gas moving through there and still maintain that vacuum level. So it's actually the residence time represents, in a lot of cases, the freshness of the etchant gas that's in the system, loosely speaking. The dark sheath is the area adjacent to the plasma generating electrodes that appears darker than the rest of the plasma glow region. The dark sheath or ion sheath is a result of lack of electrons and a stronger electric field, as well as less residence time compared to the glow region. So we'll look at that a little bit more when we look at the model. But basically, the dark sheath area is when you strike up a plasma in an etch tool in a vacuum chamber, you'll have a glowing region, and then separated between the glowing region and the substrate is this dark region. And that's where ion acceleration takes place in our system. The sheath potential is the potential difference from the glow region. So that's the glow region above the substrate and the substrate in our system. And that's represented in negative volts. So the limits of wet etch, so what we want to look at is, you know, why do we care about in this lecture? So why are we discussing dry etching, and why is it important? And I think it's really critical in today's society or modern manufacturing or modern, you know, items that everybody takes for granted. But for the most part, wet etching is limited to 2 or 3 micron pattern features due to liquid trapping or surface tension. So if we were trying to make a hole inside a substrate and make a geometric feature in a substrate, we can only get geometric features that are around 2 to 3 microns large. And again, this is dependent on the material that we're etching. It's also dependent on the wet chemistry. So naturally, you know, the viscosity of the fluids, etc. But around 2 or 3 microns, if you would have a fluid go into a hole, you couldn't get the fluid back out, and naturally your pattern would get larger at that point. Or maybe it would bridge across there with surface tension, and you really couldn't get, you know, per se, loosely speaking, an acid done into some kind of geometric feature so that it could etch that geometric feature away. So we'd have this surface tension, which would allow the liquid to go inside a hole. So that's interesting, and you know, we have to look at the scale. So our discussion is based on scale. So why is 2 or 3 microns important? And that's important because a lot of modern devices that you would take for granted, like microprocessors, computer chips, memory, you know, digital cameras, the things that make modern electronics work or the internet, those are all submicron features. So we really couldn't have digital cameras unless we had submicron features. So what I'm saying is if we were limited to wet etching, you couldn't have cell phones. And if we were, or they would be really large. If we wouldn't have dry etching, if we would only have wet etching, we really couldn't have digital cameras, or we certainly couldn't have, 10 megapixel digital cameras widely available. They would just be too large and take up too much energy. So the smaller feature size allow a lot of the things that we take typically for granted in today's modern society. So really, without dry etching, it would be very difficult to have microprocessors, memory, digital cameras, processors that are on cars. So this really helps society out quite a bit, and it's an enabling technology. So to go submicron, you need dry etching. So that's why today's chapter in nanotechnology is really important, because it is something that we see every day in modern society. So wet etching tends to undercut and produce sloped sidewall profiles. So there's a picture of that I'll get to in a minute. Wet etching needs rinse and dry steps. So there's more steps than just the etch step itself. So you need a rinse and dry step. So it's really a 3-step process. Wet chemicals can also be hazardous, toxic, and expensive. And certainly this is from the environmental aspect. So typically, like in dry etching, for example, if we were to use a common chemistry like hydrofluoric acid, so HF, if we would use HF gas in a cylinder for a dry etch tool, I know here in our research work at the university, a typical cylinder with maybe a couple gallons of HF liquid in there might last us a year or two. And I know at our research facility, we go through, you know, gallons and gallons and gallons of HF, every month. So actually, as a conservation, using the chemistry in the gas phase uses quite a bit less of the material. And that's really important, because not only do you have to buy material like hydrofluoric acid, but you have to be willing to pay to get rid of it. So it's actually a lot easier to get rid of the byproducts of the dry etch process than liquid etch. So it costs a lot of money to do liquid etching. Wet processes present material contamination issues. So naturally, if you're going to use a wet etch process, you might have, say, some receptacle with a gallon of wet etch in there. And what you would do is dunk your material that your substrates in that material, that wet etch material, multiple times. And every time that you would reuse that chemistry, naturally, the chemistry would change because the molarity changes, it's contaminated, etc. So it's not really a repeatable process. You know, it's difficult. It's a lot easier, I should say, to get repeatable processes in dry phase chemistry and reactive ion etch than it is in wet. In wet, there's a lot of accepted variables, and the etch conditions change all the time. So dry is very precise, and wet etching has, some problems associated with repeatability and contamination naturally in its nature. So now let's move to plasma etching. So let's describe what plasma etching is. And again, this is a review of looking at, and these things were discussed when we discussed the hardware issues for plasma processing. But the plasma etching is a balance between the chemistry, which is the selective removal, so removing what's intended and what's protected, and of a material through chemical reactions. It's also non-selective material through ion bombardment. And this is basically related to power and pressure in our system and in our hardware design. So non-selective removal materials through ion bombardment. So basically, I always say that ion bombardment is blind. So typically, you know, the energy for an ion or an electron for ionization to take place is a number of tens of electron volts. So typically that might be 20 or 30 in a typical material. And it's different for all materials. But if you had a number that was greater than that threshold energy, say 50 electron volts, you could do most, you could ionize mostly any or make a reaction take place in any bond. So typically, if you would have 50 EV of electron volt energy in an ion, you could do everything. So to that ion, it doesn't matter. There's no selectivity. It would actually make or break a bond with that amount of energy. You could also, in plasma energy or plasma etching, we can actually use sidewall polymers as like this pseudo mask to help control our etch profile. So we can modify our geometric shape by, in real time, allowing some masking material to form on the sidewalls of our geometric shape. So what we look at is, if we would look at this, the first bullet here is selective removal. So I would define that as chemistry. The non-selective removal, the next bullet, would be bombardment. And then the polymerization is the deposition of polymer. I would define that as P. So if I was look at these things, so I would say the first bullet is chemistry. The next bullet is bombardment. And the next bullet is polymerization. So basically, if we vary these parameters, we can determine the etch profile. So a lot of times what we can look at is we can look at the bombardment. So if I, again, if I would review these bullets, the first bullet on here, I would identify as chemistry. And then we'll have to have the interaction, which I'll represent by some asterisks. And I'll say that that's reacting with our second bullet, which is bombardment. And then that's going to react with our third bullet on here, which is the polymerization. And basically these things, this chemistry interacting with bombardment plus polymerization, when we vary these parameters, we can have a different etch profile. So let me just draw, you know, a quick cartoon here. If I would have a small amount of chemistry interacting with a large amount of bombardment and no polymer, then I would have a specific etch. Likewise, I could have an etch that had a huge amount of chemistry, no bombardment, and no polymer. So again, these constructs would actually geometrically impact it. So these are energy vectors, and as we would make these energy vectors big or small for any of these different representations of energy, we can actually have different geometric shapes. So within a plasma, there's a number of species that we have to look at. So there's radicals, ions, neutrals, electrons, and film formers. And these film formers, we can add chemistry to our plasmas to help form this pseudo mask that we can put on the sidewalls in real time. So we can put these on. So they're desired sometimes, and we put them in. And there's also dilutants. So these dilutants that we can actually enable in and that word spelled incorrectly, but the dilutants in our plasma, what we can do is we can actually add some type of like buffer type chemistry inside our plasma, and we'll go over that a little bit later. So the contents of a plasma, a dry plasma may contain radicals that chemically react with the substrate and surfacely remove material. So I'll identify this as the chemistry. And then ions that remove material through physical bombardment with no selectivity and provide uniformity. So they're uniform across the surface because they actually, their bombardment is blind. It doesn't select any atom. It has enough energy to make or break a bond with mostly anything. Again, the assumption is that we have enough threshold energy to do that. And that number might be, you know, roughly 50 electron volts. So that's our bombardment. Neutrals. Those, actually, it's interesting that inside a plasma, in a typical etch plasma, you know, 99% or 90% of the material in there actually is just dormant within the plasma. It's not energetically enabled in any way. So it's usually 99% of the plasma is just neutrals, and only 1% inside the plasma system, 1 to 2% of the material that's in the plasma system is actually in the ionized state. Electrons actually aid in sustaining the plasma. So the electrons are bouncing around within the plasma, hitting into other electrons and causing disassociation. And we would also use the electrons to form our DC bias on our cathode. So if we would recall the hardware picture, so this would also be DC bias. And film formers provide sidewall passivation, so these are optional in our thing, and these would be called our polymer, right? So that's our plus P. And the dilutants are inert gas introduced in the reaction chamber along with the process gases to maintain a desired reaction rate. And these could be in different forms. So typically we could add dilutants, and sometimes a dilutant would help maybe hold heat within a plasma. So typically a lot of times a popular dilutant might be helium because it's inert. It won't add to the chemistry. It would keep materials from recombining chemically, separate them, so it would act as a buffer per se. And also what it would do is it would add heat to the plasma. So helium likes to have a lot of vibrational energy, so it would actually change the temperature within the plasma system. So dilutants could be used to control reaction rates by acting as, in some way, loosely speaking, as a buffer. And it could also add or control the amount of heat within a plasma reaction. So selective etching is done so that certain material is removed, but other materials or areas of the material are not ideally affected. Selective etching is difficult to achieve when chemically different layers from similar etch products. So, for example, we would look at some main materials that are commonly used in nanotechnology because they're economically favorable, they're widely available and rather inexpensive and easy to process. So if we would look at the material silicon dioxide, silicon and silicon nitride, which are very popular materials for a lot of reasons, what we're trying to do in our example is we would add free fluorine. And what we would like to do is we would like to take our group 4 material and put fluorines on each end, like this. And then we would make, if we would represent this X as being silicon, we would form SiF4. And SiF4 is our volatile compound. So we're trying to take a solid and turn it into a gas. So if we would take silicon and add 4 fluorines to the end, to the 4 bonds that are available in silicon, then we would form SiF4. It's no longer a solid. It goes away as a volatile compound, so it turns silicon into a gas. So I always picture, silicon as, like a tack or something, or as a jack. Like as a kid, you play with jacks and marbles and stuff like that. What we would do is this fluorine, I picture as balloons. So you would take these balloons and connect it to the jack, and then it floats away. So it's kind of like a gondola. So these fluorines would come attach themselves to the silicon, and then just float it away. So I think that makes us a nice picture for your head, for a little cartoon for you to imagine. But if we would look at other, simply if we would look at SiO2, what could we do with that? I mean, simply, we don't have to balance equations here or whatever. We could look at this as silicon plus oxygen, and naturally the oxygen is going to go away as a gas. And then our silicon, and we're going to make it SiF4. And then the SiF4 is going to go away as a gas too. So in this case, really to our chemistry doesn't matter, it doesn't care. It wants to form SiF4, and it doesn't care if there's a byproduct of oxygen in there, or if it would form other compounds of fluorine and oxygen. That really doesn't matter. So for fluorine, when it attacks the surface, it's always going to form SiF4, whether in the case of silicon dioxide or silicon itself. Same thing with silicon nitride, and to ignore the balancing, what we're going to form is SiF4, and then we're going to form a number of 2N2s. So nitrogen N4 is going to be converted to N2, and it's going to go away as a bunch of N2 products. So basically, to the fluorine environment, simply, the fluorine environment, silicon dioxide, silicon and silicon nitride all look the same. So that they all look like they want to be SiF4, and these other things like oxygen or nitrogen, they just decompose into a gas state. So really, it's very difficult to take a fluorine-containing gas like CH4, react it in a plasma, and have that selectively etch silicon dioxide, silicon, or silicon nitride. They really etch at, you know, kind of approximately the same rate. Naturally, there's little other gases that we could add in there, per se, like dilutants, like hydrogen, and we can add the selectivity in those cases. But basically, it's very difficult to do, and sometimes you would like to go to different chemistries. So in that case, maybe for silicon and silicon dioxide interface, if we would like to selectively etch silicon, what we could do is use chlorine. And chlorine, for example, would like to etch silicon, but it doesn't like to etch silicon dioxide. So we might go to a different type of chemistry that might be highly selective for one of these flavors of silicon compared to the other flavors of silicon. So now let's take a look at some models. Again, this will help us review maybe the hardware technology or give us a little picture, a cartoon picture of what we're doing or trying to obtain in this exercise. So let's look at this simplified plasma model. If we would look at a chamber, you know, this is a cartoon of a chamber from the side. If we were looking at a chamber while it's active and the plasma is taking place above the surface. So if we look down at the bottom in blue, we have the surface interaction, and that's on the substrate. So above, right above that, we're going to have the dark space region. And this is where neutral transport diffusion takes place and also ion acceleration. So in our scenario here, the surface interaction, that substrate is going to be capacitively coupled to the power supply. And that's going to allow the disassociation from these electrons that are in the plasma. If they would go over to maybe the sidewall of our chamber, our sidewall is going to be grounded. Our electrons are going to be taken to ground. But if our electrons go down to the capacitively coupled substrate, what they're going to do, since this is capacitively coupled to our power supply, the electrons cannot go to ground. What they're going to do is they're going to build up on the surface, and they're going to make this negative DC plane. So now our ions, which are, for our consideration, the positive ions, it gives us a nice place for these ions to actually accelerate across this region. So basically, they're gathering momentum. The ions are positively charged. They see a negative plane, and given enough space, they're going to develop kinetic energy, momentum. They're going to crash into the surface, hopefully with enough energy, binding energy, that they can actually start to knock atoms free, per se. So this is a look at our simplified plasma model. We have our radicals up here, so that's our chemistry. So in our plasma, what we're doing is we're tearing apart, making really unique chemical reactions within our system, given the appropriate input chemistry. So we make these unique chemistries, and also this chemistry is going to go down to the surface along with our bombardment over here, and we're going to have this synergy of chemistry and bombardment on the surface to actually rapidly take our solid material and turn it into a volatile compound. So ions versus radicals in a plasma, or let's look at these. The radicals are molecules or pieces of molecules that contain unsatisfied bonds. So naturally, these things want to chemically react with the surface. And certainly we tune that chemistry or select that chemistry so that it does have rapid reactions with the surface. And then the ions are molecules or pieces of molecules or atoms that are negatively or positively charged. We're generally concerned with the positive ions that are focused, that are focused for bombardment because they can easily be drawn to the cathode, which holds the samples. And by definition for us, the cathode is negatively charged, because that's that plane of electrons on the surface. And then you might have to ask, you know, what happens to our negatively charged particles or negatively charged ions in the plasma, because they're produced also. And then you have to say, well, now our choices are our chamber, as you recall from looking at the hardware, our chamber is at the ground. So it's actually at the grounded plane. So the negative ions that are in the plasma can have a choice to go to the cathode, which is also another negative plane, or they could go to the neutral ground plane, which is the walls of the chamber. So naturally, the average ion, negative ion, is going to see the negative plane is not a good place to go, because naturally opposites attract and likes would repel. So a negative ion is not going to be attracted to the negative plane of the cathode. it would actually go over to the sidewalls. So what does this mean? What's the bottom line here? So negative ions, to me, don't do any work to the substrate. They'll actually be attracted to the sidewalls of the chamber, and they kind of represent dirt and debris. So a lot of times the negative ions will actually go over to the sidewalls and coat the chamber sidewall. So they'll naturally pick up an electron from ground, but then that material goes on the sidewalls and kind of dirties up the system. So the positive ions do work for us. They actually are attracted to the negative plane on the substrate, and they're used as the bombardment in our chemistry and bombardment scenario, and they get work for us done on the product that we want to produce. Whereas the negative ions actually go to the sidewall, and they're actually something that we don't want. They're probably going to contribute to contamination and dirt in our system. So the terms of temperature, chemistry, and bombardment, you know, what's important here? I mean, to get work done, you need energy. So let's look at, identify these things. So chemistry is selectivity for us. So that's our big C. Bombardment is uniformity. That's our big B. And then we have temperature. This temperature actually controls the rate of reaction. So chemistry is naturally E to the KT. So this T in here is the temperature on the substrate. So basically the temperature in an average plasma system for reactive ion etch, a good ballpark number, an easy number to remember, is about 100 degrees plus room temperature. So room temperature is, 23 degrees, 25 degrees C or so. So you would think that the average temperature in a plasma might be about 125 degrees C. So now, what can we compare or contrast that number to, or why is that number important? Well, most likely in most scenarios for etching, we would use a polymer-based photoresist as our masking material. And a general rule of thumb, I mean, this is a, estimate of all different photoresists, and actually different brands of photoresist, have different melting temperatures or different glass temperatures where they begin to sag the profile. The photoresist, generally it's thought of, most photoresists don't degrade or have a sagging or a glass temperature less than about 150 degrees C. So what this is saying is basically, if we would use photoresist, which has a melting temperature or a sag temperature of 150 degrees C, the plasmas are a standard plasma, a low density plasma. It has a temperature that's conducive to that. Later on, in our presentations, we'll discuss, the hardware where we'll look at high concentration of plasmas. So we'll look at high intensity plasmas, and actually those can exceed the 150 degrees, C threshold of most resist. And then at that point, we'll modify our hardware to have our cathode where the, substrate resides. We'll have that as a heat sink. So we usually have a helium backside cold, substrate. And what we would do is sink that temperature to a standard temperature. That's generally a good rule of thumb that most substrates, and again, depending on the recipe and the intended resultant etch profile that you want, you vary the temperature. But, a general rule of thumb is most substrates are a liquid cooled through helium backside cooling as the conduit to sink the heat. Most cathodes are cooled to maybe 30 degrees C or something like that, room temperature, 30 degrees C. And what that does is it keeps the etch rate consistent. So, in nanotechnology, to keep things consistent is really important. Naturally, when you strike a plasma or inside a plasma chamber, it's probably residing at room temperature, 23 or 25 degrees C. And as you apply energy to there, that inside the chamber, that energy might go up to 125 degrees C. So then that's variability. So now you have a change in conditions in there. So at the surface interactions, you would like to keep that rather consistent. So most of the time, helium backside cooling is used to actually maintain a moderately consistent etch rate. So if we were to look again, what we're trying to build in our minds is, what do we have happening at our surface? Our surface is seeing a lot of energy. So our surface is seeing the chemical energy. It's seeing the bombardment energy, and it's also seeing the impact of temperature on the energy. And we could probably include in here, as we discussed before, maybe the polymerization, not as an energy, but maybe as the brakes to that energy, as to control the chemistry and bombardment on the surface, we might be able to select or engineer in some polymer film on the sidewall profiles to control the chemistry and bombardment energy in that area. Okay, pressure. If we're going to look at some, you know, important parameters in here and think back to the hardware design of a reactive ion etch, you know, the throttle valve is really the big knob on the machine. And through the throttle valve, we can actually control the amount of vacuum or pressure inside the plasma. And if somebody walked up to me and said, you know, and it's a relative question and up for debate, but if somebody would say, you know, what's the big knob on an RIE? I'd say the most useful energy parameter that we can control and really impacts the size and the geometric shape of the etch profiles that we make three-dimensionally in a substrate, I would say that's pressure. So what pressure does for us, when we do the pressure, when we change pressure, naturally, we discussed this before in the presentation, this controls the mean free path. And the mean free path is going to control the disassociation, which is going to create ions, which is our bombardment vector. It also, the pressure is a function of how much chemistry is inside our vacuum chamber to take place and to do our work. So pressure is also chemistry. So if we were to look at, you know, what are we trying to identify? We're identifying the chemistry and the bombardment vectors, you know, and their relative vector size is actually going to create different geometric shapes for us when we do our etch work. So the pressure is actually going to make C very big or C smaller or B big or B smaller. So actually pressure controls both of these variables. And when we control those variables, we control the geometric shape of our etch profile. So that's very interesting. So pressure controls whether our shape is isotropic or anisotropic, or the degree that it's isotropic or anisotropic. So what I'm saying here is we can get rounded profiles, we can get profiles that look like a V, and we can get profiles that look like a rectangle, and anything in between. And really how we would control this for the most part, or at least the first iteration of control or energy, is to control the pressure. Because what we can do is we can look at this profile and basically say this is chemistry without bombardment. So if we would say interaction with bombardment, we would say bombardment is zero. We would say this one has both bombardment and chemistry. And if we would look at this one, we would say chemistry is rather small and bombardment is rather large. And what I'm saying is I can make these C's or B's smaller or bigger by controlling the pressure or the throttle valve on the system. So the pressure is huge, a huge construct or a huge idea within etching. And again, this will control our etch profile. The pressure also has impact on the residence time. And this, again, is our chemistry in our system. And it also controls microloading, which we're going to go over in this presentation a little bit later down. I'll spend some time to describe that construct. So pressure affects the mean free path, which controls, among other things, the degree of ionization and thus the number of ions available for physical bombardment. Naturally, it also controls the amount of electrons, because when you have an ion, naturally you have a disassociated electron, and now those electrons can be captured on the cathode to actually give us that negative DC bias plane so that we can have that set up for the kinetic energy on the surface. The mean free path, the bombardment, gets larger as the pressure is reduced. Naturally, the amount of chemistry, etching gas byproducts is reduced when the pressure is decreased. So as we go lower in pressure, so if we go from 300 millitorr to lower in pressure, which would be 30 millitorr, our chemistry goes down. But at that point, our mean free path goes up, and we have enough, and our mean free path goes up, and we would have more room to gather kinetic energy to have more DC bias on the surface. As low pressure will increase bombardment and uniformity, but it decreases selectivity. A high pressure will decrease bombardment, decrease uniformity, but will generally increase the selectivity. So let's take a look at this, you know, classic wine glass etch profile. So if we would look what's in the white region of this drawing, we would describe that as looking like a wine glass. If we would look at the top part, which is this isotropic geometric shape in this region, we would say that this generally occurs at hundreds of millitor. So in this part, our chemistry would be rather large and our bombardment would be small. And then if we would go to decrease the pressure to tens of millitor, typically in this region, in this square part, we would say that the chemistry is rather small and our bombardment vector is rather big. So we can see that when we vary these vectors or the relative magnitude of chemistry and bombardment, we're actually changing the geometric profile. And a lot of this has to do with the pressure. So simply our throttle valve set to hundreds of millitor is going to produce this type of geometric shape. And if we would select with the appropriate chemistry, if we would select tens of millitor, for most material, we would get this geometric shape. So that's interesting. By controlling those variables, we can actually craft in our surface different geometric shapes. So I think that that's, you know, startling or impressive, but I think it's certainly really impressive when we're going to say that this geometric shape or this distance in here might be submicron. So if we're at the submicron level, that's really impressive. And again, we can't make these geometric shapes below a couple few microns with wet etching. And now you could see if we could make a wine glass, we could make all kind of different geometric shapes. So we could have involved in here things that would look like triangles or circles, rectangles. And if we add those geometric shapes together, what could we draw? You could draw or craft in a three-dimensional objects in a substrate, you know, really unlimited amounts of geometric shapes in there. And that's really impressive for all kind of different applications. So this is the, you know, really the punchline here is with an RIE, you know, the big knob, by controlling pressure, we can create geometric shapes that are submicron three-dimensionally inside a substrate. And that is a nanotechnology, you know, chapter in nanotechnology. That's huge. And that's an enabling technology that would give us things like, digital processing and cell phones, digital cameras, et cetera. So that's a huge construct. So dry etching is important to give us those different geometric profiles. So power naturally is another important energy parameter. Power also affects the ionization. As power increases, ionization also increases. And power and pressure are interrelated, and the effect of power depends on the operating pressure. So actually the pressure is still the big knob. At certain pressures, if we would go higher in pressure, say at 300 millitor, and if we would double the power, we really wouldn't see that much energy would go into the plasma and be, it wouldn't very much create a different etch profile on the surface. Whereas if we would change, the pressure by a large percentage, our geometric profile would change quite a bit. So depending on where we are at in the pressure regime, at what pressure we're at, power or the impact of power is going to be different in that area. And that impact of power and how it would impact the geometric profile is going to be nonlinear across that scale. So this is the energy to minimize or to ionize a particle. So if we would look at the energy to ionize or make or break a bond on a particle, if we would look at these numbers and you know, just say, for example, if we had 50 electron of energy from an incoming ion, then we would have enough energy to ionize a particle on the surface or create a chemical reaction on the surface. So if we had 50 electron volts, we're able to modify any of these materials. So that's why bombardment is thought of, at least as I would describe it, bombardment is blind. So if I had 50 electron volts, could I ionize any of these particles, or could I make or break a bond on any of these materials? And the answer is yes. So bombardment is blind. If I had something like 50 EV, I'm able to modify all of these surfaces. So certainly they're all different, but if we were beyond the threshold for these numbers, we can consider them all able to do the work. So now let's take a look at the six steps of plasma etching. So we'll look at a cartoon figure. So I'm going to refer to this slide right here. So what we're going to do is describe this slide. So we'll go by numbers, the generation of the plasma species, the etch and diffusion, then the adsorption, and that's not spelled incorrectly. Adsorption is actually the surface reaction. The reaction, which would be number four, which is the volatile product leaving the surface. Then we're going to have number five, the desorption, and six as the diffusion back into the bulk of the gas. So this is what we're going to look at is, you know, plasma etching. So basically, to look at this in detail, what happens intricately on the surface? So, and number one, referring to this slide here, we're going to have reactive etch species are generated by the electron molecule collisions. So within the plasma, we're going to have the fourth state of matter. We're going to have this these unique reactions taking place. So we're going to develop some unique chemistries in the plasma by that energy being applied, the electrical energy applied to the plasma with the incoming chemical reactive gases. We're going to have some unique reactions taking place. We're also going to create free electrons, which can be collected on the substrate, on the cathode and on the substrate by a capacitor. And that's going to build up our negative DC bias. So we have chemistry and bombardment. We have the ions created in the plasma at that point. Number two here, we have the etchant species are going to diffuse through the stagnant region, which is the dark sheath, to the surface of the film to be etched. So this is where they gather momentum and kinetic energy. The etchant species adsorb onto the surface. So the etchant species could be the chemical reactions. And now the ion bombardment can also provide energy to drive these reactions. So we need a threshold energy to make this reaction happen. And the energy can come from different regimes. The energy could be from heat to help in our threshold energy to make or break a bond to cause disassociation. It could also come from light energy, UV, X-rays. It could come from different regimes. It could also come from kinetic energy, which would be the bombardment energy. So now we're going to look at the drawing again. So we had the adsorption. Number four is the reaction that takes place. The reaction takes place at the surface. And this is where, for example, if we had silicon, we're going to be gathering the fluorine on each of the bonds on there. The group four material would have four fluorines. And once it gathers four fluorines, now it's going to turn into SiF4. And SiF4 is no longer silicon as a solid, but it's going to be silicon tetrafluoride as a gas. So the reaction is going to take place, form silicon tetrafluoride in our example, and turn into a volatile product. So what we're seeing is our volatile product represented over here is going to be, for example, SiF4. It's going to now desorb from the surface as SiF4 diffuse back into the bulk of gas and be pumped away in our vacuum pump. So this our scenario here is how do we take a solid and turn that solid into a gas. And once it's as a gas, what happens as a gas, it gets pumped away into our vacuum pump and gets removed from the system. So this cartoon represents how do we take a solid surface and using reactive ion etch techniques, turn that solid into a gas and create a geometric shape.